The memory of the sweetness of that worship at the shrine of the Lar of the people was a solace and shield to me in the dark time that followed. Something had changed in the weighting of the balance. I no longer had to hide away, isolated from the current of public feeling. I was buoyed up by it, borne on it. My courage was restored. Yet there seemed no reason why I should feel such confidence. Any hope of obeying the oracle, or following my fate as the poet told it, seemed lost. When my father proposed placating the Trojans by giving them land or building ships for them, he had not even spoken of my part in the original bargain. It seemed I was not worth mentioning. My mother had what she wanted, war against the foreigners, with Turnus in control of it, lord of the kingdom and the king's daughter. Yet she went back to the Regia with that same bewildered look on her face and shut herself up in her rooms while I was released from my seclusion. I found a kindness in the eyes of the men in the streets, the women of my household. They spoke my name tenderly. I felt welcomed, protected. My home was my own again, even if it was under siege. I went to the king's apartment and talked with him very briefly. Haggard and aged, his eyes red and swollen, he told me to come to him with any news of great importance, otherwise to let him be. He was not well. I asked him to rest and sleep. Verus and I would meet the messengers, I said, and come to him if need arose. So I spent some of that day in the atrium and at the doors of the Regia with Gaius and the other men of the king's guard, receiving couriers from the battlefield. There was a constant flow of men and news between the city and the fields in front of it, where the Volscians and the Latins were taking up position for battle under Messapus and the Volscian captains. Scouts reported that Aeneas had sent his horsemen and the Etruscans forward, while he had led the rest of his troops up into the hills northeast of the city. Verus said it looked as if his goal was to come out at our army from two directions. So Turnus had taken his Rutulians up into the hills, intending to set an ambush for the Trojans at both ends of a pass. I knew the place. Golo Pass, the shepherds called it. A narrow, dark gorge. An army might well enter it and be trapped. Such news came to us quite steadily for a while. In the early or mid-afternoon, there was a pause. Leaving Verus in charge at our front doors, I ran up to my watchtower just for a look, I thought. I stood at the parapet to look out over the roofs and walls to the exercise grounds and fields north of the city. In several long irregular lines beyond the earthworks stood the ranks of Volscians with their black helmet crests, and behind them our Latins, very motley in their helmets and hand-me-down armor. Horses fidgeted, and their riders let them dance and curvet. Archers and men with long light lances stood around in front of the Volscians, some fidgeting like the horses, others looking bored, leaning on their lances, chatting together. The watchtower had the widest view in the city, and we on it may have been the first to see the glint of light on the metal tips of lances far off over the fields in the north. A boy on a pony came scouring across the pastures, the pony white with lather, the boy yelling. I could not hear his words, but he was surely yelling, "They're coming!" And they came. It was very beautiful, the bristling glitter of lance heads far off there, moving quickly nearer and nearer. The air was shaken with the thrilling drum of the feet of horses at the gallop. All along the lines of men drawn up in front of the city, spears and lances reared up into the sunlight, and horses began to whinny and shift and fight the reins. Then the Etruscan horns and trumpets sounded their battle signals, some deep and hoarse, some silvery sweet. The attackers came on. The defenders stood firm. For a moment everything seemed to stop, hold still. With a blare of the horns and a great shout of men's voices, arrows and javelins and lances went up from both sides, a swift darkness passing and crossing in the air between the two armies. Under the iron rain, they met face to face, men afoot and horsemen, body to body. I tell you what I saw as I saw it, not understanding it. I saw men running towards the city, converging on the gate. I thought they were the attackers. I could not understand why they suddenly began turning around, running back towards other men who, when they met, fought them, swords rising and falling. Then men were running away from the city, holding their shields behind them as they ran, and mounted men and riderless horses ran with them, and other men followed them, until suddenly those being chased turned around, and the swords went up and down again, and there was the horrible noise of men screaming. And it all happened over again. It was like sea waves approaching the city and washing back from it. But the spray was dust, thick, dark summer dust. After that, there was no running and turning, only knots and pairs of men chopping at one another in the dust with swords, and throwing and pushing heavy lances at one another, and blood running where the sword bit and the spear point hit. Mars, Mavors, Macte Esto. I do not know how long it went on. I stood clutching the parapet of the platform, Maruna and the other women with me, and women and children stood on all the roofs and on the walls, watching men kill men. The snarling trumpets rang out again. A group of horsemen far out in the fields moved forward in a solid mass, like a shadow across the ripening crops and the Pegasus paths through the hot, slanting light full of dust. Before that mass, the lines and knots of fighting men gave way. Very quickly, the movement involved them all. They were turning and coming back to the city, the Volscians with their black horsehair crests. They were all running back towards the walls. Both armies, all the men down there in the field, were running towards the walls in a cloud of dust that half hid them. Fine dust of the plowlands billowing up brownish gold. Sunlight making strange hollows and aisles in it through which loomed the shapes and shadows of horses and men. The city gates were open. They had been open all through the fighting. I thought, I must go down and give orders that they be shut. Maruna held my arm. I did not understand why I could not hear what she said to me. She put her mouth almost on my ear, crying, "The guards will defend the gate. Stay here. Stay up here." As she drew away, something passed us perfectly silently and lay still on the platform. A bird, I thought. They shot a bird. But I saw it was an arrow. It lay there with its long, bright bronze point and stiff, clipped feathers, harmless. I could not hear anything because the noise down at the gate and the noise on all the roofs and walls of the city was so huge. A screaming, a howling that filled all the world and the mind. From the watchtower, we could not see what was happening at the gate. But we could see those who could see, standing on the walls above and near the gate. Some of them were watching their son or husband die, cut down by a bronze sword in front of the locked gate of his city. We saw the Etruscans pull away, and the black-crested Volscians follow, though fewer and slowly. The Volscians stopped just outside the ditch. The Etruscans went on 100 paces or more before they stopped, wheeled their horses, and stood motionless in the dimming, settling dust. There was a long pause, the sound of shouting fading slowly away, rising in pitch as it grew less, till it was only the crying and moaning of the wounded and bereft. "Look, look," somebody said. And where she pointed, we saw a column of men coming at a quick pace, though in the distance it seemed slow, down out of the western hills. "It's Turnus! Turnus is coming!" people shouted from roof to roof. An old man's voice shouted, "Where's he been all day?" But he was drowned out by cheers and acclamations for Turnus and the Rutulians. The cheering rang thin and did not last long. Somewhere down near the gate, a woman was keening, a gasping ululation, intolerably shrill and full of pain. I went down back to the doors of the Regia then, so I did not see, as others did, Aeneas lead the Trojans down out of the hills on the same road Turnus had taken, not far behind him. The Etruscans drew back farther to join with the Trojans. What was left of our men and the Volscians camped, with Turnus' Rutulians, between the earthen rampart and the city walls. They spent the evening digging the ditch deeper, setting up defenses for the gate. I did not see that. At first, I was with the women looking after the new lot of wounded men in our courtyard. And then I saw my mother pass under the colonnade, going to the council rooms. At once, though I stopped at the fountain under the laurel tree to wash blood hastily off my hands and arms and bathe my face in the blessed cool of the water, I followed her. I joined her and Juturna at the back of the council room. My father sat on his throne with its curved crossed legs. He did not look like the shaky old man I had last seen, but sat erect and stately in his red-edged toga, listening to Turnus. Drances was there, and Verus and several of the other guards and knights, but only a few of the king's council. Most people were caring for their wounded or mourning their dead, or were out helping fortify the walls for siege. Turnus was still in battle gear, though in fact he had not fought that day. He was dusty, and his face was strained and pale. He was not strutting now. He looked young, anxious, handsomer than ever. Amata and Juturna both stood watching him with yearning eyes. He was giving a report of the conditions of the allied army to Latinus, not trying to disguise that his ambush had failed, or deny that the Volscians had broken and run, nearly bringing the Etruscans after them into the city. But he praised Messapus and Tolumnius, and the Latin troops, and the citizens, too, for rallying at the city gate and holding firm.
"Tomorrow," my father said, "you and your men will be with them, and Aeneas and his men will be with the Etruscans."
"Yes," Turnus said.
There was a pause. He shifted his position, stood with his legs a little farther apart, his head back.
"I do not hang back. There is no delay in me,"
he said rather strangely, his voice growing louder.
"If people say the treaty was broken, if the Trojans think so, I give them the lie. Repeat the rites, King Latinus. Renew the terms of the agreement tomorrow morning before all the people. I swear to you here and now, I will by myself clear our people of the taint of cowardice. This Trojan, this man who ran away from his conquered city. Let him meet me. Let him meet me alone in fair fight. Let all Latium be on the city walls to see it. Either my sword will take all shame from us and take Lavinia from him, or he will rule a defeated people and have her as his wife."
He glanced at us three women standing behind the throne as he finished speaking, but his eyes did not meet mine. Latinus answered him with a slow, thoughtful firmness. On the eve of defeat, confidence had returned into him, as it had into me.
"Turnus, no one questions your courage. It is so great, in fact, that it obliges me to move slowly, to hold back. Consider, your father gave you a noble kingdom. You're rich and have the goodwill of your neighbors. You know that I am your friend, your kinsman by marriage. And there are many girls of good family unmarried in Latium. Weigh all that in the balance. For whatever happens, I cannot give you my daughter. It is forbidden. It cannot be done. My wish to make the bond strong between us, my wife's pleading, my own weakness led me to do wrong. I broke the pledge. I let it be thought that the promised wife could be taken from the man she was pledged to. Wrongly, I let this war begin. Let it end now before a final defeat. Why have I changed back and forth like this, hiding from the inevitable? If I was and am willing to take the Trojans as allies while you're alive, why should I wait for your death to do so? Consenting to this duel, I betray you to your death. Let it not be so. Let my old friend, your father, Daunus, see you come home alive. My sword can draw blood, too," Turnus said.
He had been pale, but was now red-faced, his blue eyes glittering.
"You needn't try to protect me, Father Latinus. The story is that some power hides this Aeneas from his enemies in battle. But here, on our ground, The powers are with me. I will defeat him.
At this, Amata started forward, ran to Turnus and took his arms, half clinging to him, half kneeling as a suppliant. Her black hair was loose, and she was in tears, her voice high and shaking.
Turnus, if you ever loved me, you are our only hope, the only savior, the honor of this disgraced house. All our power is in your hands. Don't throw it away. Don't throw away your life. What happens to you happens to me. I will not be a slave to foreigners. I have no one but you. If you die, I die.
Hearing her begging, I blushed with shame, till tears filled my own eyes. I felt the red blood color my face, my neck and breast and body. I could not move or speak. But Turnus looked over my mother's head straight at me, the bright, unseeing stare that had frightened me the first time I ever saw him. He spoke to her, though he kept looking at me.
No tears now, mother. No ill omens, please. I'm not free to put off death. I've already sent a herald to the Trojan. Tomorrow morning there will be no battle. The treaty will be resworn. He and I alone will meet. Our blood will settle the war. And on that field, Lavinia will find her husband.
He smiled at me, a wide, fierce smile. He put Amata away from him, pushing her hands away. She cowered down, sobbing.
The messenger has gone?
Latinus asked. His voice was dry.
He may be there by now,
Turnus said proudly. Latinus moved his head once, the nod of acceptance.
Then go make yourself ready for your fight, my son,
he said, with kindness, and stood up, dismissing the others. He turned around as they left, and I think he was about to tell me to look after my mother, but he asked,
Daughter, are you hurt?
I saw where he was looking. There was a great smear of half-dried blood all down my palla, which I had not seen in the twilight courtyard. No, I've been with the wounded men, father.
Take some rest tonight, my dear. Tomorrow will be a long day for some. Go, sleep well. Juturna, go with your brother. If you can persuade him out of this duel, do so. There is no need for it. We will restore the treaty and the peace.
She hurried after Turnus. When the others had all left the room, Latinus went back to Amata, who was hunched down on the floor, her hands plucking and tugging at her hair. He knelt by her and spoke softly. I could not hear what he said. I could not bear to watch them. I went back out across the courtyard and to my room. As I meet them in the courtyard of our house, Ascanius is saying something jokingly to his father. You said it yourself. Come to you for work, but not for luck. Then he goes off to do whatever it is that Aeneas has asked him to do. And I ask Aeneas, what did he mean?
Oh, it's something I said to him when we couldn't get that arrowhead out of my leg. I said, you can learn a man's work from me, son, but if you want good luck, go to somebody else. I was in a foul mood.
What arrowhead?
The last morning of the war.
I puzzled it over. But Turnus didn't have a bow. He was using his sword.
Turnus?
The wound in your leg.
Turnus never wounded me,
he says grimly. Then his face changes.
Oh, I see. I lied to you, to some extent. I lied to everybody, actually.
Explain, please. We sit down side by side on the bench under the laurel sapling.
Well, it was just after that augur, that Tolumnius threw his lance to break the truce. I saw him do it. He killed a young Greek on the spot. Then, of course, they all went mad. I was trying to get our men together, out of it, keep them from fighting. Fighting there, at the altar where you were standing.
His face goes dark again at the thought of it.
And in all the confusion, somebody got me in the leg with an arrow.
You don't know who? Nobody ever claimed the honor, he says with a bit of mockery. Seristus and Ascanius helped me get out of the mess back to our camp. Seeing the captain down is frightening to the men. I had to hop along leaning on my spear, bleeding like a sacrifice. So, old Iapix did his best, pulled out the shaft, but he couldn't get the arrowhead out. It was barbed, you see. And everything was going to pieces back there. So I said, tie it up, man. I can't stand around here all day. I have to find Turnus and finish this thing. I made Iapix do it. Once he'd stuffed the hole with Dittany and had it tied up tight, it didn't hurt. You don't notice that sort of thing much in the thick of it. So I went back looking for Turnus and couldn't find him. I'll never understand it. What was he doing? I'd see him not too far off now and then he'd disappear like a swallow in an atrium, flit past, gone again. I'd go where he'd been, and he wasn't there. I was running out of patience. And just then, Misapus knocked off my helmet crest with a spear, and I lost my temper. So I called for an attack on the city. He looks down, frowning, at his hands clasped between his knees. I am sorry about that. It was wrong.
So Turnus didn't wound you? You were already wounded when you fought him?
He nods, rueful at having deceived me, or at having been caught at it. As soon as I got back to camp afterwards, Iapix got the point out. It practically jumped out then.
He looks at his tough brown thigh and pokes the dent, a hand's breadth above the right knee, deep and red among other older dents and scars.
Healed up amazingly fast, he says, as if this excused everything.
Why did you let me think it was Turnus that wounded you?
I don't know. I suppose a lie extends itself somehow. I had to pretend it didn't amount to anything, you know, while the fighting was going on. As I said, it worries the men. We were so outnumbered, it was always chancy. And I had to find Turnus and fight him to end the whole thing. It was the only way. So then afterwards, when I could admit that I'd been hit. In fact, as you remember, I was pretty lame for a while. It didn't seem important how it had happened. I didn't know you thought it was Turnus who did it. It doesn't really matter, does it?
He asks this not boyishly, seeking excuse, but gravely, to find out if it does matter very much to me. I have to think about it a while. No, I say, and I lean down and kiss the scarred dent in his thigh. He puts his arms around me and lifts me up against him. His hands under my loose gown are large, warm, rough-skinned and strong. He smells of salt and incense. I did sleep that last night of the war, slept soundly, deeply, so that my waking was slow. At first it seemed to me that there was something I must do for my mother, but I could not think what it was. Then I came a little farther out of sleep and thought that there was to be a ritual, and I should help my father with it. Then I woke and saw my small window just showing the first beginning of light in the sky, and 100 images of bloody wounds and dying men I had seen yesterday went through my mind in a rush, and with them the poet's voice chanting. And then came the knowledge that today we would either renew the Treaty of Peace, or the fighting would be in the city itself, and my people defeated, destroyed. I got up and put on my old red-edged toga with the scorched corner, and ran to my father's apartment to wake him. But he was up and about already. He did not question my presence or my intention to go with him. Together with Drances and a couple of older men, we got the ritual implements together, and I brought out the bowl of salted meal to the stable yard, where the animals were to be selected from herds brought in from farms overrun by the fighting. By the time we had picked them, it was time to lead them out to the sacrifice. Soldiers on guard opened the city gates for us, hailing the king with a clash of weapons on shields. They made to shut the gates behind us, but Latinus said, "Let the gates of our city stand open." He strode ahead of us,
holding up his oak scepter like a lance, the wide purple-red edge of his toga showing bright in the dawn. Our army was drawn up all in order, facing outward from the walls and the earthwork that had been built up outside the ditch. Across a narrow space of farmland, trampled to dust now, the Trojans and Greeks and Etruscans were just forming up their ranks. A space between the armies had been lustrated, marked out as sacred, and an earthen altar set up in the center. Old men from the city were busy piling up firewood in the hearth they had made beside it. Latinus strode directly to the altar. He held out his hands, palm up. Young Kesis, our salt boy, was ready with a fresh-cut piece of turf and put it square on the king's hands. Latinus set it on the altar. Just as he did so, the sun shot its first ray over the eastern hills, and Aeneas came forward between the armies and stood across the altar from the king of Latium. Everything happened as if it had been planned and rehearsed 100 times. Everything happened as it should and must. With Aeneas came his son, Ascanius, standing behind him, and Turnus came to stand behind Latinus at the altar. Aeneas wore the magnificent armor and carried the shield I came to know later. The crest of his helmet was a red plume that looked like the flaming cloud of a volcano. Turnus was as splendid in gold-washed bronze, with a plume that towered up white and streamed in the wind of morning. His sister stood near him in her gray veils. My father had pulled up the corner of his toga over his head, as I had done. The walls and roofs of Laurentum, when I looked back and up at my city, were dark with people, women, men, children. They were all silent, and the men of the two armies were silent. I stepped forward with the bowl of salted meal. My father took up some in his hands and sprinkled the sacrifices with it, a young white boar and a 2-year-old sheep with very fine white wool. Aeneas came forward and took up meal in his cupped hands from the bowl I held out to him. It was the first time I was ever close to him. He was a big man, all bone and muscle, tanned dark. His face seamed and weathered, worn and fine. He was the man I knew and had known since the poet spoke his name in the glade of Albunia. I looked up at his face, and he looked down at mine. I saw him recognize me. He turned away to sprinkle the meal over the animals. I gave my father the little ritual knife I carry, and he carefully cut some hair from the forehead of the pig and the sheep. He gave me back the knife. I held it out to Aeneas. He took it and cut a bristle or two and a curl of wool and gave the knife back to me. Then they both stepped to the hearth and dropped the offerings into the fire. Kesis brought the wine jug and the old silver cups on a tray. He poured the cups full and gave one to each king. First Latinus, then Aeneas poured out the libation over the green grass on the altar. My father spoke the ritual words in a low chanting voice, invoking the powers of the earth, the hour, and the place. Aeneas stood, gravely listening. In all this time, there was hardly a sound from all the people gathered there. A baby's wail up on a rooftop in the city. A clink of bronze as a soldier shifted his stance. Birds singing far off in the trees of the city streets. And the broad, sweet silence of the brightening sky over all. My father's prayer was done. He stepped back a little. Aeneas drew his sword. The hiss of bronze on hardened leather was loud. He held the sword up over the altar and said, "Let the sun be witness to what I say, and this land also, to which I have come through much suffering. Let Mars, who rules the war, let the springs and rivers of this earth and the sky above it and the sea that washes it bear witness. If Turnus is the victor, my people will withdraw to Evander's city in defeat, and my son will leave this land and never return to it in war. But if I am, as I may be, given the victory, I will not make the Italians my subjects, nor claim rule over your land. Let both our peoples, unconquered, pledge eternal treaty. With me come my gods. Latinus, my father-in-law, will keep his sword and his rule. My people will raise up a city, and Lavinia will give it her name. He looked directly at me as he said that, not smiling, but with a brightness in his face and eyes. I looked back at him and nodded once, very slightly. He lowered and sheathed his sword. My father stepped forward to face him and held up his heavy oaken staff over the altar.
By the same powers, I swear, Aeneas, by earth, sea, stars, the Lord of Lightning, and two-faced Janus, and the shadows under earth, I touch the altar. I swear by this fire and the powers that stand between us. Never shall this peace and truth be broken, whatever may come. Never shall my will be changed, not until this staff, the ancient scepter of the lords of Latium, bear branch and leaf.
He nodded to the men who held the animals. They brought them forward with the long sacrificial knives, and Latinus cut the sheep's throat, while Aeneas cut the boar's, each with one quick, experienced stroke. And at that, the people, soldiers standing by, and citizens up on the walls, broke the silence with a long, soft, quavering ah of release, relief, fulfillment. Now an Etruscan haruspex came forward to look at the entrails of the sacrifice, a matter the Etruscans consider very important. And the animals had to be cut up, and the meat spitted and cooked over the fire. This all took a good deal of time. Aeneas and Ascanius stood back from the altar, keeping silent, as did my father. But Turnus began to talk with his sister and with a Rutulian chief, Camers, who stood beside her. Despite his gilded armor and gorgeous plume, Turnus looked pale again and tired, as if he had not slept. He kept gazing around at his men with a grieving, pleading face. And the Rutulians began to gather around him. Camers talked to them not loudly but earnestly, and they listened, looking grim. The augur, Tolumnius, moved about among them, also talking. The haruspex took forever poking about in the livers and hearts and kidneys. The attendants put too much meat on the fire at once and nearly put it out, so that it had to be rebuilt to burn high. The murmur and mutter of talking grew louder through the ranks of the Italians. The sacred moment was lost, past. The sun was getting higher. The day was beginning to be hot. People looked up and pointed to a faint clamor in the sky. A great flight of swans was coming from the river, heading south past us and the city, flying lazily left to right. The Greek and Trojan troops followed the bird's flight, as we Italians and Etruscans did. And so all saw the sudden eagle, arrow fast from the east, seize the lead swan in its talons in a shower of feathers, and shoot on in a wide curve over us, heavily carrying its prey. Then, most strangely, the whole flight of swans turned as one, flying low and fast, the shadows of their wings passing over us, chasing and driving and harrying the eagle, crowding it till it dropped the dead swan and flew up and off over the western hills. A hesitant cheer went up from some of the watchers, but most were silent, wondering at the meaning of the sign. Into that silence, Tolumnius shouted out, "An omen! An omen! Rutulians, Latins, obey the omen! Attack the attacker! Close ranks! Defend your rightful king!" And as the men around him shouted and shook their fists in the gesture of Mars, Tolumnius heaved back his 6-foot spear and threw it straight into the ranks facing him across the sacred ground. A man bent forward over the shaft, making a strange noise like a cough or laugh, clear to hear in the last moment of the silence. Then the world was filled with the enormous, bewildering roar of men shouting, drawing weapons and clashing shields. Men rushed past me, this direction and that, shouldering me unseeing. I could see nothing I knew anymore except the altar. I pressed up close to it. My father was there with the boy Kesus, trying to take up the sacred dishes, his hands shaking. "Help me, Lavinia," he said, and I took and carried what I could. Keeping close together, we struggled away from the altar through the confusion of running men and plunging horses towards the city gate. Kesus was not with me, and I stopped and looked back for him. I saw an Etruscan in splendid armor trip and fall backward, sprawling head and shoulders right across the altar. Another man leapt at him and struck down at his exposed throat with a massive blade-headed spear, and the Etruscan's blood spouted up over men crowding in to tear the armor and weapons off him. Some Rutulians had pulled long burning sticks out of the sacrificial fire and were using them as weapons, shoving them in men's faces so there was a stink of burning hair. Beyond them, for an instant, I saw Aeneas, taller than the others, his hand up, calling out in a great dark voice. Then somebody shoved me so that I nearly fell, and the boy Kisses, his face distorted with tears and terror, was tugging at my robe. I hurried on after my father. The gates of the city stood open above us. My father's guards had gathered around us, and they brought us in. The confusion in the streets was almost as bad as outside the walls. People were shouting that the Trojans had broken the peace and treacherously attacked the king at the altar. Many old men and boys, even slaves, rushed out to join the battle. The king's guards kept the great gate open for them and for the wounded to take refuge. Women stood up on the walls screaming insults and throwing down clay bricks and whatever they had to throw at men fighting at the ditch and rampart. Other people rallied to the streets between the great gate and the regia to protect their king if the enemy broke into the city. Others were feverishly burying their treasures in their garden or trying to wall up their doors and windows so they could hide inside their house. I followed the king directly to his council room, where Drances and others who had escaped the fighting gathered. Drances was gibbering with terror and talked only about where we should hide. My father was shaken, out of breath, and gray in the face, but he sat on his throne and began to consult with Verus and the others and give orders for the defense of the city and the house. Seeing myself unneeded there, I ran to the women's side, where there was nothing but dismay and rumor and wailing. My mother was in her apartment, but she came out to meet me. She spoke to me with savage contempt. "So, that's how your great Trojan keeps a treaty. He swore peace," I said. "He attacked your father across the altar. He did not. He pledged peace with him. He asked to fight Turnus hand to hand. He swore if he lost, they'd leave, and if he won, Latinus would still be king of Latium. And father swore to that oath. But Juturna and the Rutulians didn't want that, and Tolumnius called an omen and threw the spear that broke the truce. I was there. That is what happened." "It is not true," she said. But she knew it was. After what I had seen, I had no fear to spare for her. I heard my voice ring out stronger than hers. I felt taller than her as I stood facing her. "If Turnus had come forward to fight Aeneas, there'd be no war now. The city would be safe," I said, for my heart was hot with anger. "He betrayed us." "Turnus would never," she began. And then, her voice shaking, she said, "It was for you. It was for you. Turnus doesn't care a stick for me or you either," I said. I heard myself speak with the sneering stridency I had so often heard in my mother's voice. I thought of the clarity of the sky above the altar between the armies as the two kings swore the treaty. A great swell of shame and passion ran all through my body. I knelt down before my mother and took the hem of her white palla. I said, "Mother, forgive me. Let us have peace between us."
"Never. He would never," she said.
She looked around as if bewildered.
"Is it my fault?" she cried.
She turned away, pulling her gown out of my hand, and hurried back into her own apartment and closed the door behind her. I crouched there, weeping for a while. Tears that had been pent up in me through these terrible days poured out. Then they were done, and I put back the hair from my forehead and wiped my face with the edge of my palla and stood up, looking at the women who were watching me in awe and concern and confusion. "It was Turnus' people who broke the truce, but it will be the Trojans and Etruscans besieging the city," I said to them, groping for the truth I needed and the reassurance we all needed. My voice quavered. "So we have no true friends but our own Latin men fighting out there, and ourselves. What can we do to make the house safe and wait out the siege?" They all gazed in silence, some of them sniveling, until Maruna said, The storerooms are full, I said. Praise be to our Panades. The storerooms are full and the fountain runs. Is there plenty of firewood for the cooking stoves? That was indeed a problem, and something within our scope. A discussion arose about it, and Titus said, we could cut down the laurel tree. At that, Sicana, the tall, grim woman who had always served and sided with my mother, said,
are you mad, Tida? Go wash your mouth out and beg all that's sacred to give you the wits of a rabbit. Cut down the king's tree? Idiot! There's the old poplars back of the stables to start with.
I put Sicana at once in charge of finding men with axes to fell and cut up the trees. Then there were 100 other things to be done, and women willing to do them. The battle outside the walls went on all this time, all that morning. I saw none of it. I heard the noise of it only when there was some pause in the business of the house. I can tell only what I was told. The Rutulians at first, in the surprise of their assault, drove the Trojans and their allies back. But after that, the battle moved steadily nearer the rampart and ditch outside the city walls and gate. Messapus was in charge of the Rutulians. Turnus was here and there,
but never staying in one place, said the man who brought us the clearest report.
This man, Melus, had been among our recovering wounded in the Regia, and went out to fight again. His wound, a bad sword cut, reopened as he fought. He managed to get back inside the city while the gates were still open. He reported to the king that the Trojans were not trying to get closer to the gate, but were holding their position on the rampart while Aeneas hunted for Turnus, claiming his right to settle the war by single combat. And Turnus rode here and there through the fighting, mounted on his horse, dealing out death, but never letting Aeneas meet him. After Melus had made this report, clearly and quietly, he fainted from loss of blood. And though we did what we could for him in our courtyard hospital, he died that evening. He was a Latin farmer, with a small farm and orchard in the foothills south of the city. I was trying to direct the sweepers to use mops and soaked rags to keep the courtyard pavement clean of blood from the wounded men who were continually carried in, when the roar of noise swelled up immediately outside the city gate. All of us in the house looked up from what we were doing, and some ran up onto the walls and the watchtower to see what was happening. They reported to us that the Trojans had crossed the space between the ditch and the walls and were attacking the city gate, led by their tall captain with the red crest on his helmet, although the crest had been sliced off short. One of the girls who had gone to the wall above the gate said the captain was shouting that the Italians had broken the treaty twice and their king was faithless.
And he killed Verus, she said.
She was white as whey and talked in a high, monotonous voice, repeating things over and over.
He just sliced off his head. Just sliced off his head. Off his body.
Verus, I said, not comprehending yet. There was too much to do. I was aware, even inside the Regia, that there was a great movement of people in the streets. Some were pressing to get down to the gates and throw them open in surrender. Others were trying to get down there with pikes and poles and axes and kitchen knives to keep the attackers out of the city. The noise within the city was a dull, mindless roar. Somebody shouted, "Fire!" And at that, I did run up onto the platform to see if the Regia was threatened. Flaming missiles were flying up over the walls in a couple of places, but people in the streets below rushed to put them out. Still, the cry of fire was repeated again and again, and the dark, buzzing, wailing noise of the people all over the city was so loud one could not think. Through that noise there came from down in the house a shrieking of women, so keen and sharp I turned and ran down the stairs again and to the women's side. There the screaming and high wailing rang and echoed, so I could not hear what Sicana, coming at me with her mouth open in a square and her eyes unseeing, cried to me. I followed her to my mother's rooms. I saw Amata hanging from the noose she had made of twisted cloth and tied over a beam. Her feet were bare. Her long black hair hung down all round her face and body. Sicana and I pushed back the table under her, and Sicana held her while I cut the cloth noose with my small knife. We laid her down on the long table there in her anteroom. She still wore the little gold bullas my brothers had worn.
"Wash her,"
I commanded Sikena and the others, for she had soiled herself in her agony, and I could not bear for her body to be shamed. What I had to do was tell my father. He had heard the frenzy in the women's side and was coming across the courtyard, Drancy's and some others following him. I stopped him under the laurel tree. I am not sure what I said. He stood a while. His face looked very tired and sad. He embraced me, and I held to him. I said, "Come to her." At that, he let me go, and slowly got down on his knees and picked up dirt from around the roots of the laurel tree and rubbed it into his gray hair. I knelt by him, trying to give him comfort. I realized that, though the wailing went on in the women's rooms, the noise of the city and the war had sunk down almost to quietness. I looked up and saw people standing motionless on the walls of the house and the platform. They were still. It grew still. Then there was a great sound like a deep breath, like the earth breathing, all around the walls. I thought it was earthquake, the sound earthquake makes as it comes. But it was the sound of the end. The war was over. Turnus was dead. The poem was finished. No, but it was left unfinished. Didn't you tell me that, my poet? Here in the sacred place, where the stinking sulfur water comes up from under the earth to make pools on the earth, and the stars shine between the leaves? Once you said it was not complete and should be burned. But then again, at the end, you said it was finished. And I know they did not burn it. I would have burned with it. But what am I to do now? I have lost my guide, my Virgil. I must go on by myself through all that is left after the end, all the rest of the immense, pathless, unreadable world. What is left after a death? Everything else. The sun a man saw rise goes down, though he does not see it set. A woman sits down to the weaving, another woman left in the loom. I have found my way so far, even though the poet did not tell me the way. I guessed it right, without mistake, from things he said, the clues he gave me. I came to the center of the maze, following him. Now I must find my way back out alone. It will be longer and slower in the living, but not so long, I think, to tell. There were many who saw Turnus die, for it was before the gates of Laurentum that he finally stopped hiding from Aeneas and turned to fight him. Both men threw their spears and missed. So they met sword to sword, but Turnus' sword broke, and he turned and ran again. Aeneas tried to chase him, but was too lame to run. He stopped and tried to pull out his spear from the wild olive trunk it had hit. That was a sacred tree. I had done worship to Faunus there many times. The Trojans had cut it down in a rage of destruction when they occupied the ramparts, and nothing but the stump was left. The spear was big and heavy and had gone deep, and the tree would not let it go. While Aeneas was struggling with it, Juturna ran up to Turnus and gave him a sword. Aeneas pulled his spear free at last and came for Turnus, shouting, "This is a fight, Turnus, not a foot race." Serestus was close to them then. He told me he saw an uncanny thing. An owl, a little owl, flew round Turnus there in the broad daylight. He said that Turnus tried to keep it from his face. He seemed dazed, bewildered, like a man already mortally wounded. He ran off a short way again till he came to a terminus stone, a boundary marker. He stopped at it, turned, picked the huge stone up, grappling it in his arms, and threw it at Aeneas. It fell short by far. Then he stood there with the same bewildered look, holding his sword but doing nothing, till Aeneas brought him down, sending his heavy spear through Turnus' thigh. Aeneas came limping up and stood over him, breathing hard. Turnus couldn't get up. He struggled to his knees. When he'd got his breath, he spoke clearly and quietly, as if his confusion had passed. He said, "You've won. I ask no mercy. Do as you will. If you kill me,
send my body home to my father. Lavinia is your wife. Don't take your hatred further.
Aeneas listened to him and drew back as if to spare him. Then he saw Turnus had on the gold sword belt he had torn off dying Pallas. He shouted out,
"Did you let the boy live? It's he. It's Pallas who makes this sacrifice."
And he drove his sword into Turnus' heart. Juturna had stayed on the battlefield all through the fighting. They say she had more than once hidden her brother from Aeneas, who came stalking him, lame and dire. She came forward now through the broken Rutulian ranks and knelt by Turnus' body, her gray veils falling over him and keened. Aeneas stood there leaning on his sword until Achates and Seristus came to him. Then he sheathed the sword, and with an arm round his friends' necks, they helping him to walk, he began to hobble slowly back to the Trojan camp. He turned round as they crossed the rampart and called out,
"King Latinus, our treaty holds."
Latinus was not there to answer him. He was in an inner room with his dead wife, dust in his hair. But the Latin troops replied, many-voiced,
"The treaty holds,"
and people on the walls repeated it. The few that were left of the Rutulian captains, for in his final fury, Aeneas had killed every man who dared meet him, gathered their troops together and formed a group to take up and carry the bodies of Turnus and Camers and Toluminus. In silence, they began their long walk back to Aerdia. The leaderless troops scattered out to find rest or find their dead comrades. Next day, they too would straggle back to Rutulia or Volscia or the hill country. Juturna went alone northward. People saw her go, but she was never seen again, and it is thought she drowned herself that night in the Father River. The Latin army dispersed as the allies did. Some came into the city for rest or healing, but many went to find their dead brothers or neighbors on the battlefield and carry them home, back to the farm down the valley or over the ridge. Already from the nearby homesteads, slaves with carts drawn by an ox or a donkey were coming out, sent by the farm wife or the old farmer to help carry the wounded and the dead. That night in the city, we heard the knock of axes, the distant crash of falling trees, in the woods north and east of the city. Next morning, the woodcutters were busy hauling in wood for pyres outside the walls. One pyre was built up high and separate for my mother. She was carried out on a white litter, dressed in the delicate white pallas she had woven, and called my wedding gown. Everyone in the city who could walk followed the procession. The closest relative of the dead lights the fire, with face averted. I lit her fire. When the fire had done its work, I picked out of the fierce smoking ashes a bone, a little finger bone, to bury in the earth, so that her soul need not wander. Then my father stood and called out her name three times, as is our custom. And I and all the people called her with him, "Amata, Amata, Amata." And silence after that.